When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Eureka. Extraordinary ideas explored by ordinary minds.
What?
I mean, it's an absolute liberty, that. That comes from George Nichols on Twitter.
I like it. It's cheeky. Cheeky from George.
Extraordinary ideas explored by ordinary minds.
Well, I mean, I suppose if you're talking about the listeners, I mean, I think you and I are extraordinary.
The problem.
We're not, are we?
No, I don't think we are.
No.
The problem is it's a good tagline.
Yeah, I know.
That's why it's a good, accurate tagline, and I hate it. So, unlucky George, we won't be using that. What we do, as you know, is each week we invite a new expert to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
This week, we are going to talk about irrational phobias and obsessions and mania.
Oh.
Have you got any in your locker? I feel like you probably
no
have.
No phobias.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any obsessions. There's things I don't like I can't touch cotton wool, or certainly can't pull it apart. I don't know if that counts as anything.
Yeah, it probably would. That's probably a phobia. But I mean,
and I don't like watching people brush their hair.
What?
Well, like anything to do with that kind of texture and stuff running through that texture. It's the same with the cotton wool thing. Just
when
can't.
You had hair, did you mind?
My hair's fine because the comb slips through nicely. I'll tell you what, cutting my toenails, can't bear it. But that's because when I was a kid, my stepdad was cutting my toenails once and he cut my toe. And so I've just like got an absolute sort of almost, I can't even talk about toenails really.
So we'll go, did I ever show you my gammy toenail?
No.
Oh, I wish I'd
known. I hate toenails so much.
It's actually sort of back in business and looks glorious now.
But my no, it doesn't.
It does.
It's a toenail. It does not look glorious.
Trust me, next to what it did look like, it looks glorious.
Right.
So I got some sort of fungal infection meant it was just like a complete, it was mainly missing. So you just saw the soft underbelly, which is horrible anyway, and like really sort of scabby. And it was like that for years.
That's disgusting.
Like years and years. It was embarrassing to wear open-toed sandals.
Were you married
just
at this point?
Because they're open-toed sandals. Yeah.
So that's lucky, isn't it?
Yeah. No, but it had... So when I met Ema, the toe was like that and it didn't put her off.
No.
Yeah, it was like it for years.
Is that how you knew she was a keeper?
Yeah. It's like, kiss the toe. I wish I'd known that you had a problem with them. I could have tormented you.
You could have done. I'd have just looked away or closed my eyes. I mean, literally, I cannot bear
it. I'd send you photos and you'd open them on your phone. You'd be like, ah! I wonder if I've got any old photos, actually. I might as well dig them out.
I'm just not accepting any photos from you now.
Sort of the anti-dick pic. Okay, so, all right. So you've got cotton wool. I think that probably is an established sort of mild phobia.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, yeah.
But, I mean, it is, we'll get into this. Oh, sort of.
I'm shivering, literally thinking about it.
But it's not that bad, is it? Like, if I bought some cotton wool in...
and see, just, I can't even keep still while you're talking about it.
Just like fingering it, would you mind?
Pulling it apart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind. Yeah, I wouldn't watch you. I wouldn't watch you do that.
But could you do it?
I can do it if I have to. So I had to do it with the kids, like when they were having nappy changes and use a bit of cotton wool and stuff. You know, I had to just.
What are you using cotton wool for?
I can't remember.
I'm
pretty sure we used cotton wool for stuff.
What?
I don't know. Maybe it was like putting it in my ears when they were screaming.
Okay, so that that, fine. The toenail thing, I think, is interesting because there's lots of discussion about
where... And that's a trauma. I mean, that's a trauma-induced phobia,
and trauma, sort of early, like, childhood trauma, I think, can give rise to, you know, certain mild phobias.
What about you?
No, I don't think I've got any. Like, I certainly none that I can think of.
Really?
Yeah.
You're so well-balanced.
I think so, yeah. That was my conclusion. Because they're really common. Like, I think 70% of people will say they have some kind of irrational fear.
What I'm thinking is, you remember back to our psychopath episode?
Yeah.
When we kind of established that you're borderline getting there.
No, I wonder. I was just further along the scale than you.
Yeah, all right.
Which we expected.
I wonder if you
not a psychopath.
Don't have any irrational fears of anything because you basically don't have many fears of anything or strong sort of feelings about stuff.
Well, the only thing I could say is, but then there's no way I could put this in a category of a phobia, is I don't like jumping off high stuff. But then why would you?
It makes no...
I do get there are some people who...
So, it's not vertigo.
No, it's not vertigo. No. It's just I get to... So, and this happens repeatedly because my friends know it. If I go on holiday with my friends and there's a fucking big rock somewhere over the sea... We always have to go and jump off it.
Yeah,
and a big part of the reason is they know how much I hate it, but they also know that I'm too proud not to do it.
So you will do it.
So I do it, and I fucking loathe it. I absolutely loathe it. I don't get any of the sort of there's no
Absolute
sense of euphoria.
Props to your mates.
Oh yeah. But you know them. They're dickheads. But they're quite funny. So every time, and I hate it, but I don't think that's. Well, for me, it's not irrational at all.
Yeah,
because you're worried that you're going to whack your head.
Yeah,
actually, I don't really like diving, and the reason I don't really like diving is from watching Greg Louganis. Do you remember him?
Oh yeah,
the diver in the 1988 Olympics.
Smashed his head
on the dive on the way down.
Yeah,
and what I always took, and this to me feels quite logical. What I took from that is this guy. He went on and won Olympic gold. This guy is the best diver in the world,
he's fucking smashing
his head on the board. What hope do I have? I'm not fucking with that.
I wouldn't jump off like a 10-meter board. Because why would I do that? There's no obligation to do it, and it doesn't make sense to do it.
Yeah, and it's not like you're suddenly going to discover that you're brilliant at it.
No,
it's not an untapped talent.
No.
You're just going to fall like a sack of potatoes.
It's sort of the same reason I wouldn't go skydiving, probably, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's part of me would quite like to experience skydiving, but there's also a part of me that goes, some parachutes don't open.
Yeah, no, what I think I'm the same. I would quite like to quantum leap into someone who was skydiving and experience it for, and then quantum leap out again.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in the bit where I have to jump out the plane. Not doing that. And I'm not interested in the landing. I'd like to just be in the middle bit. The middle bit looks quite good, but I'm definitely not prepared to do the other stuff in order to experience it.
And I think that's common sense.
Yeah. So I guess there's a bit of height stuff, but I definitely don't have... I wouldn't say I was scared of heights.
No.
I just don't want to jump off high things. Thank you.
Fair.
Thank you. Have you ever found yourself obsessing over something to the point where it feels like you can't control it? Maybe it's a particular food, a hobby, even a person. You know it's irrational, but you just can't help yourself. Where do these irrational obsessions come from? Are they the result of a deep-seated psychological issue, or is there something else at play? Perhaps it's a way of coping with stress or anxiety. Maybe it's a way of feeling in control when everything else in life feels chaotic. This week, we're asking, where do irrational obsessions come from?
Presumably, there's an expert here.
Oh, yeah, and she's a really good one, actually.
You.
No, it's not. No idea about this. Kate Summerscale. So she's a journalist and award-winning author. I mean, aren't we all?
I'm not.
Am I? No.
Not really.
You were the judge on a book competition I got shortlisted for once.
And you still didn't win.
And I didn't win. I mean, that is... We didn't know each other as well then, but that's a disgrace.
I'd forgotten about that.
Back to Kate Summerscale, who has won some awards, and rightly so. Her latest book is The Book of Phobias and Manias, A History of the World in 99 Obsessions. It examines the history and treatments and theories about why we become obsessed with things. And it's... I honestly mean this in the most complimentary possible way. It is the perfect book to have in your loo.
Oh, I know exactly
what you mean.
For someone
to dip into, because it's sort of... It basically just goes... it's disrespectful to call it just a list, but it's like, it's just chapter by chapter, loads of different phobias, lots of history and stuff about them. It's great to just dip into.
Yeah, yeah.
Just flick to any page, you're like, this is interesting.
Yeah,
What do you mean you're phobic of blushing? Grow up.
I love books like that. There's not enough books like that.
No.
Too many are trying to, you know, have some
spin
great
out this big narrative. Yeah, oh, yeah. Give over.
Yeah, yeah, quite.
You want narrative?
I don't need
read a novel.
I don't need 400 pages of your theory that could be summed up in a magazine article.
I mean, we've had this conversation before. There is almost no non-fiction book that couldn't be chopped in half.
Yeah.
And it would be just as good.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my view.
Except mine.
Well, no offense.
All of mine.
13 Things That Don't Make Sense is one of my favourite, if not favourite, popular science
books. I've never seen a but coming, yeah. More obviously.
But it could have been 11 things, couldn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You know it could. You true. Know it could.
It probably could have been 9 or 10.
So not quite half, but you definitely shave a couple off there.
But I couldn't argue with that at all.
Why did you do 13?
Because it
sounds good. It sounds good, yeah.
Absolutely.
How many have you got? 9 or 10, maybe? Okay, going to need a couple more. Actually, 10. I mean, you should have just done 10.
No, 13.
Yeah.
It's 13 things. I mean, the alliteration works.
Yeah.
Actually, there's plenty more, because I did a follow-up article for New Scientist, 13 more things that don't make sense. I could have brought some of those in, but I didn't. We made editorial decisions. It's fine.
Yeah.
Let's move on. It was a long time ago.
Didn't win any awards. but anyway, my point is that...
Whereas 7 things that don't make sense.
Would have swept the board. Kate's book is... Well, it's 99. 99 Obsessions.
Oh, nice.
And it's really... It's really good. It's really fun.
Yeah.
And I've only read about 10 of them, but I really enjoyed it.
So how do you kick things off with her?
Well, obviously I told her I loved the book. And then I just asked her to tell us about some of the most interesting cases of mania that she's researched.
The outbreak of choreo mania, or dancing mania, on the banks of the Rhine in the 14th century was a strange phenomenon where people started wildly dancing in villages, and the dancing contagion would spread. People would dance so much that they would cut their feet. They would sometimes suffer seizures and even die. And the authorities were unable to work out what was going on, why it was happening, how to stop it. Sometimes they provided halls for people to dance in to try to at least contain or to order this craze. And it's sort of fascinating, as with many of these outbreaks of communal, what used to be called hysteria, or sort of mass panics, or there was many theories about what caused it, ranging from the biological, physiological. So perhaps these people had been become delusional because they had been poisoned by a mold that was growing on their wheat supply. The banks of the Rhine had recently flooded, and the harvest had been moldy. But other theories suggested that it was a religious mania that was caused by new religious sects moving through Europe and whipping up a frenzy.
I mean, that takes us back to our Evolution's Greatest Hits episode, where I said fungi are amazing at controlling stuff.
Yeah.
Imagine if that was a mold that just made people dance like idiots.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fungus is getting out of that, but I still like it.
No, my sort of overriding caveat for this episode is it feels like quite a lot of hokey science of people just speculating and able to prove nothing. So
that's our favourite kind of science.
Yeah, so they're kind of, you know, well, it might have been mould. Like, yeah, fine, maybe. Not going to be able to prove it now. But yeah, I mean, there are certainly amazing examples in the animal kingdom of fungus sort of taking control of things. So
yeah.
I guess it's not impossible. But there are some sort of remarkable examples through history of group mania. So this dancing mania is one of them. There was one, a sort of epidemic of demonomania, I think is how it's said.
All right.
Which is sort of fear of being possessed by a demon. And it broke out in the mid 19th century in Haute Savoie. Don't know where that is, but somewhere in Europe.
France?
I guess could be sort of Belgium, couldn't it, or something?
I suppose it could. Yeah.
And you had so it's. I read something which said at the peak of the epidemic, 100 townspeople were convulsing, hallucinating, prophesying, frothing at the mouth, speaking in tongues and performing acrobatic feats. To be honest, it sounds great.
I would watch that.
You pay good, keep your Cirque du Soleil. I want to see a load of nutters who are terrified of being possessed by demons.
Presumably rural nutters as well.
Yeah, the best sort of nutter. and then you've got, like, when we're talking about the sort of the heights thing and sort of not liking, or being fine with heights, not wanting to jump off high things, there is this vein of phobias, in inverted commas, where they just seem to be quite reasonable. So there was one in the 18th and 19th century called taphobia, which is a fear of being buried alive. And the reason for that is fundamentally at that time, a lot of people were getting buried alive. And so you're like, well, yeah, I would really hate that. And so, yes, I mean, I guess I am a bit scared of that.
It's a bit like having a fear of being hit by a bus.
Right, yeah. It's not fair to say that's a phobia.
I actually look before I cross the road because I've got a fear of being hit by a bus.
Not to diminish people who have phobias, but
no.
Absolutely to diminish people who have phobias.
Yeah, I mean, if it's going to kill you, I don't really know that it counts as a phobia.
No. Well, in sort of the modern definition of a phobia, it wouldn't count because it being irrational and disproportionate.
Yeah,
is
yeah, disproportionate
the
reaction. Yeah,
exactly, okay. Exactly. I mean, I don't know how many, there's so many phobias, all of which, a lot of which are quite funny. So
unless
I'll just
it's
go
you
through,
that's got them, obviously.
Even then, you've got to laugh at yourself, haven't you? So erythrophobia is, so it was originally an intolerance for things that are red. Man, I mean, grow up. But anyway, now it's people who have a pathological fear of blushing, like they hate going red.
Okay,
And the good thing about that is obviously it's self fulfilling because as soon as you're like getting really really anxious about the fact you hate blushing, then you start to blush and then it just builds and builds.
Yeah, yeah. And then all the people who are laughing at you are also going slightly red.
Literally that. So that's quite a good one. And it's hard to work out. I mean, first of all, no one's quite sure what purpose blushing serves anyway.
Right.
And then people try to work out whether people who have erythrophobia do actually blush more. And so they did some experiments, and it turns out that they don't. They're just more aware of it.
Yeah, okay.
So you kind of, it really is completely in their head.
But once you're self-conscious about it, it's a problem, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. But also still just ridiculous, isn't it?
Well, no, it's not ridiculous. If it's giving away a signal that you're nervous or anxious or upset, it's sort of like it's betraying you in some ways, I think. So I think it's, I don't know, I sort of feel like if you blush and you're conscious of blushing, then you're actually sort of self-conscious and you feel like now people are judging me. So if you're in a situation where you're embarrassed and you just make it worse, that's going to make you keep away from social situations.
Yeah. I can see how it would be slightly debilitating. But sorry, I think I've explained the experiment they did misleadingly. So it's not, they actually do not blush more, these people who are worried about it. They think that they do.
And
the people that don't have any issue with blushes report they're blushing less, so they're less aware of it. And the erythrophobes are more aware of it. And possibly, like they do, their heart rate does increase more.
Yeah.
And it looks like they're mistaking the fast heartbeat
For extra
for blushing.
For blushing, okay.
Yeah. And I wonder if that sort of information would make them less concerned. If you said to them, no, genuinely, you feel like you're blushing more than the average person, but you're really not. So it's fine.
Maybe.
Yeah, could try it.
Are you going to solve all the phobias?
I'm going to try and solve all the phobias. Yeah, so buckle up. This is going to be a long episode. But I think that the really sort of weird thing about phobias and manias is they are in a really fundamental way a sort of social construct. So yeah. There was just a guy in the 18th century. So phobias and manias did exist, but they didn't describe what they describe now. So phobias were just like physical symptoms of stuff, and mania was more of a sort of social thing. I can't remember what it was. But anyway, he just said, oh no, I think these are like psychological conditions. A guy called Benjamin Rush. And then as soon as you start putting labels on,
yeah.
then people are like, oh yeah, I've got that.
Yeah, so, yeah, yeah. You pathologize it, don't you?
Completely. Yeah. And in some ways, I mean, you know, this is a wider conversation about labels, I suppose, whether labels are helpful. It does, if you have sort of a generalized anxiety about things, if you are specific with the thing, this is the thing that makes me upset, you kind of particularize it.
Yeah.
That, I think, can be helpful as a coping mechanism. So you're sort of saying, oh, actually, that is the narrow thing that upsets me and everything else is okay.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't have that, then you can just feel a more sort of blanket anxiety.
Yeah, it's like anything could
suddenly trigger it. Yeah, I don't know what's going to trigger it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it might be useful.
Do we have definitions for mania now and obsession?
Yeah, so if you go off the, what's it called? Do you know what? This amazed me. Well, it told me that I know absolutely nothing about American history. Benjamin Rush is one of the founding fathers. I'd never heard of the guy.
He's not in Hamilton, though, is he?
No, well, exactly. So,
so he doesn't really count.
No, he can't. Also, he's quite funny. I think he's quite funny anyway. So he's got, you know, all your sort of fairly typical phobias. I'm phobic of dirt. I'm phobic of a ghost. I'm phobic of rats or whatever. And then, like, some funny ones in there, like homophobia, which he said afflicted gentlemen who felt compelled to stop off at the tavern after work. Like, okay. All right, you're a bit of a one, Benjamin. So the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistic Manual number 5, which is the DSM.
Classic.
And we're definitely not going to go into why this is quite a problematic thing.
No, it's all
basic made up. But they say that to diagnose a phobia, the fear has to be excessive, unreasonable, and have lasted for 6 months or more. And it must mean that the individual avoids the feared situation or the object or whatever it is in a way that interferes with their normal functioning.
Okay, yeah.
So it's actually a fairly high bar, I think, that.
Yeah.
So, and immediately that wipes out, like, my thing, if I don't want to jump off high things, it's not excessive, it's not unreasonable, it doesn't interfere with my normal functioning at all. It's a very easy thing to avoid and doesn't impede my sort of enjoyment of life.
Yeah,
so
okay.
Definitely not a phobia.
Yeah.
And then they kind of break those down into, so you've got social phobias, which are sort of fears of various social situations. And then you've got the specific phobias, and there's a load of different types of them. So animal phobias, which we'll go into in a bit more detail, because some of them, I think you could make an argument, have some sort of evolutionary drive, although I think it's a bit iffy, the reasoning. Then natural environment phobia. So that would be sort of fear of heights or fear of drowning, you know, whatever. And then sort of injection, injury, blood type phobias. Situational phobias, like getting, well, buried alive, I suppose, would be one. Trapped in the, like, claustrophobia, agoraphobia, all those ones. And then just sort of the rest of them. So things like fear of vomiting or choking or, you know, loud, the stuff that doesn't fall into those things. So there's quite a lot of different phobias, but they're quite hard to study, because although when they've done quite a lot of research into the sort of population, the American population, and loads of people say that they have them, but not many people seek treatment because they just think, well, I'll avoid the thing.
Yeah, that, no, fair enough.
And that'll
yeah,
be fine, yeah. which is a sort of fairly reasonable way of approaching it, unless it is debilitating.
Yeah.
So it's quite a long answer to, yes, there is a definition of them. And then manias are just sort of compulsion to do something. So that could be, and we've really got a lot of discrete sort of categories for those. So obsessive compulsive disorders, eating disorders, addictions, you know, all that kind of
okay,
thing.
Okay, all that kind
yeah,
of stuff.
Yeah,
right, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But they're all within the family, that very happy family, the anxiety family. and so you'd say they're all sort of anxiety disorders, and they are very prevalent.
Yeah, and awful.
And yes, not great.
Yeah.
Not great. I do know quite a lot of people who have them, just not me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure they're very grateful to have such a normal friend.
Such a level-headed guy.
Who doesn't judge them or laugh at them in any way. So, I mean, are they serving some evolutionary purpose? I mean, you talked about fear of animals. Like, fear of animals can be quite a good thing.
Yeah, maybe. But
if it gets out of hand, like Millie, my daughter, doesn't like pheasants or fish. She won't be in water if there's like fish swimming around, for instance.
And why?
I don't know. No idea.
Pheasants?
Pheasants. She really hates pheasants.
Yeah, but hates pheasants is not the same.
But she will like have an irrational sort of reaction to even hearing a pheasant squawk.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, people get it much worse than that. I mean, I've been around people who will not be in the same sort of anywhere near a pigeon or...
Yeah.
You know, and people have
spiders
big fear
and
of...
snakes are the classic, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, look, I asked Kate, you know, is there a purpose, do we think?
In the short term, a lot of phobias and manias offer comfort to the people who suffer from them. Sometimes it's possible that people displace an anxiety onto a particular object or find relief from it by pursuing a particular action. For example, if somebody plucks their hair compulsively, which is a condition known as trichotillomania, it is a sort of self-soothing, it's a sort of self-harm but also self-soothing process. And phobias too, if you can bundle up all your fears into one object or one creature, like a spider, and then avoid that creature, it can be a way of managing anxiety. And so at a low level, phobias and manias can be ways of feeling that we are in control of the world around us and getting the dark thoughts out of our heads and onto the objects or creatures in our orbit, and that they can then be managed and controlled. But of course, if the anxiety about that takes over, then it becomes an obsessive thought that starts to control us. And I think it's when that happens that people are more likely to seek treatment for their phobia, if it becomes something that dominates their thinking instead of a way of ridding themselves of anxiety.
So people for years have been speculating on the, you know, possible function and possible causes of phobias.
Mm.
So Freud obviously said a lot of stuff. You're
just
scared
like
of that because it looks a bit like a cock. You know, that fire is quite phallic. Like, what penis are you looking at? Genuinely. Probably loads. But he did say something that, you know, it has the ring of truth, I guess, but who knows, which is that it's a sort of way of displacing an internal fear onto an external object, because it's very difficult to escape from a sort of internal danger, whereas you can save yourself from an external danger by running away from it or keeping yourself away from it. So that's like... You know, it's sort of plausible, but I mean, there's no evidence for it.
But when you say, oh, you know, yeah, they put all their fears and anxieties onto spiders, and then they don't see spiders very often, so they can live, you know, the fears don't come back. I mean, it's sort of a nice theory, but it's all it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And there's kind of the evolutionary angle of it. So Darwin, had a great reaction once to being surprised by a snake, where he said almost like by a never really come across a snake in a while before, immediately caught sight, and like a reflex, like jumped a meter back.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, that must be some sort of innate sort of thing from the past when we were, you know, when we maybe were getting predated upon by snakes, or snakes are very poisonous. And actually, that's not like a, that's not entirely unreasonable, because I think about there's what, 3,500 different types of snake, and I think about 600 of them are poisonous.
Yeah.
So you kind of go, yeah, makes a bit of sense to try and
cats
avoid.
Like automatically jump miles away from anything that's snake-like.
Yeah, and again, you sort of go, well, I can make a plausible evolutionary argument for that.
Yeah.
Where I think it kind of breaks down is why, like, it doesn't account for individual differences. Like, I have absolutely no problem with snakes.
Do you?
No, and
I wouldn't
and
choose
a lot
to be
of,
around them.
No, but that's not a reflexive jump back thing. And if it was really advantageous from an evolutionary point of view, it would get selected for.
Wouldn't it?
And as you know, yes, if you'd say, you know, what proportion of the population are scared of snakes, it might be quite high. It might be like 30% of people. But still, that's 70% of people who aren't.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of cultural baggage with that as well.
For decades and decades,
we've had films, movies, like, you know, TV programs that basically portrayed snakes as the bad guys.
Clown phobia, I can't remember what the technical name for it. That is basically was created because there was a serial killer, American serial killer in the 80s. What was his name? John Wayne Gacy, is that his name? Something like that.
Yeah.
And the press put out a photo of him dressed as a clown. And suddenly, this clown phobia just erupted.
Is that when it started?
Yeah, so that was early 80s. And then Stephen King wrote It in the mid-80s. People weren't scared of clowns. Or if they were, it wasn't a sort of common thing. And then suddenly there was an explosion because there's a serial killer dressed as a clown. And then Stephen King writes It. And then suddenly... Again, it's kind of confected.
Yeah,
all of this
stuff
created by our own behaviours, which doesn't make it any less real, I suppose. But I don't know. I do find that interesting. The other thing is snakes. A lot of people are scared of spiders. Loads of people.
Yeah,
I think it's snakes and spiders are the two top ones. Spiders. Almost all of them are harmless. Like, does not make sense.
I don't want to interact with them though.
Do you not?
No,
I love them.
I wouldn't say I've got a phobia of them, but if there's a big spider sitting on the bathroom floor, I will sort of go away, get a glass and a card, and put it out the window. I don't want it around the house particularly. I don't want to think about it, climbing over my face at night.
No, but I mean, I'm just, so in that scenario, I'm doing the same thing, but I'm just like, I'm thinking, well, the spider would probably be better off outside, so I'm just going to put it outside, and that's...
I don't think it would. I mean, if it's it's probably living somewhere under the floorboards of your house, and you put it outside, it's not saying thank you very much.
I don't know, but I'm not seeing enough, I'm not seeing cobwebs, I'm not seeing spider webs in my house. So I don't know if he's sort of ended up in there.
It could be under the floorboards, couldn't he?
Maybe I'm being harsh on this.
If you say that you don't mind them, then let them sit on the floor.
No, Ema does mind them, so that we would have an issue there, and she really minds them. Like, we had not an argument, but I was really genuinely upset one day when I came home and she had put a glass over a spider and then not done anything with it until the spider had just died in there. And I was like, what the fuck are you doing? She's like, well, it's just a spider. It doesn't matter. And I was really, I didn't like that.
I think there's a lot of people would be on Ema's side.
No, I mean, most people, I think. I didn't like it. I thought it was very, very mean on the spider, which is entirely harmless. But so there, when you're grubbing around for an evolutionary reason, it's quite hard. But there was a biologist who did do that, and he thought, I wonder if there was like one really fucking horrible spider like back in the day in our sort of evolutionary past, and it's called something amazing, and he found it. It's called something amazing, like the six-eyed sand spider. It was in a part of Africa where early humans would have been, and it would have been able to like kill a child through a bite. But it's all post hoc. All of this, it's really like we're just trying to fit some stuff on.
The other thing about spiders, though, is they're very other, aren't they? They're very like creatures that are not like us. They don't look like us. They don't act like us. They spin webs. They drink the fluids.
But aren't there
of
loads
their
of
prey?
Animals that are like that?
I don't know.
You think they're particularly other?
They feel
other.
Like they're just really other.
Yeah. Alien. Well, it's interesting that the octopus in the past has had a bit of, you know, like the sort of image of like a giant octopus taking over a ship and all that kind of stuff, which clearly would never happen. But you wonder if that's partly to do with how weird and other
they
are.
We don't like weird stuff. We don't mind sort of mammals.
But by weird, we mean just not like us, don't we?
Yeah, effectively.
Mm. Here's something that I read that I did find interesting and actually not that surprising when you give it a moment's thought, which is that on the whole, women are disproportionately phobic. So roughly twice as many women suffer with phobias as men, especially in the years in which they can bear children. And effectively, it's just like a heightened level of caution. Just trying to protect them and their offspring. But also, literally, because the environment in general and even now is just more hostile to the social environment, is just more hostile towards women. And so they have more genuine reasons to be afraid, which is awful. And not only that, but their fears are more likely to be dismissed as being irrational, hysterical.
Right. So when Ema says, you know, in a few years' time, let's not get a clown in for the party, which mm-hmm. you've already booked.
Yeah.
For your kids, like, let's say, fifth birthday party. Mm-hmm. We're going to get a clown in. And Ema says, no, we're not. What do you say?
I say, well, I spent quite a lot of money because this clown comes and it's got a clown's head and then a spider's body. it's sort of animatronic. So, actually, I have to say, not being phobic of either spiders or clowns, I wouldn't love seeing a half clown, half spider coming over the horizon at me. Like the end of Wild Wild West. You ever seen that?
No.
The absolutely terrible Will Smith
vehicle.
And there's some, it's huge. I mean, I can't even just, I mean, have a look at it. It's completely ridiculous. Okay, time for a quick break. When we get back, we'll be discussing how phobias manifest differently in different cultures, whether any of it is curable, and of course, we'll be answering today's question, where do irrational obsessions come from?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit. And he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes. I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly. Seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
And we are back.
So we can learn to fear things. That's the thing.
Yeah. Completely. So there are certain... So
nobody's born like with a fear of the number 13.
No, of course not. No, that's entirely cultural.
Yeah.
Although, in cultures where the number 4 is unlucky or fear, because it sounds like the word for death isn't it? You look at the statistics... If you die of like a heart attack or something like that, it's something like you're 17% more likely to die on the 4th of the month, which is amazing, which kind of goes to show the power of the superstition.
I was going
to
say, that's just because, there's a subset of people who are more anxious and more susceptible to kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But imagine that, though. I mean, that is really like, phobia-ing yourself to death.
Although, I mean, you would think that if it was the 4th, you'd be extra careful, wouldn't you?
You would think so, but apparently...
It's like, I'm not jumping off that cliff today because it's the 4th and, 4th is death and...
Oh, no, but this is like heart attacks, so stuff like where your stress levels are going to have an impact.
So,
it's not an accident. Yeah.
So you're more stressed.
Yeah. Basically, you're more likely to believe, oh, of course I'm going to die today, it's the 4th.
Yeah.
And then that, then...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Becomes true.
Yeah, well, just stop thinking like that. That's just stupid.
Yes, it is. Kate mentioned when I was talking to her about how phobias and manias can manifest differently in different cultures.
There's a surprising consistency across different cultures about, for example, the animals that we're scared of. There are little sort of spikes in different countries of certain fears. There are cultural differences, though. For example, in the West, we're scared of the number 13, which has a sort of history, and in some people it can be a sort of obsessive superstition, which is rooted in, the 12 disciples, the 13th person at the table. Also in Norse mythology, the West has a sort of a history that has given rise to this particular fear. Whereas in the East, in China, South Korea, Japan, there is a similar and perhaps even more pronounced terror of the number 4, so that many hotels won't have floors that include the number 4, or aircraft won't end in a 4. And this is because the number 4 in various Eastern languages sounds very similar to the word death. So that's obviously driven by language, but suggests, it reminds us of how superstitious we all are in terms of attaching meanings to symbols as well as creatures and objects.
We are so irrational, aren't we? I mean,
yeah.
It's like there's a highway, I think it might be Arizona or New Mexico, in the States, that it was like Route 666 and they had to rename it because people wouldn't go on it because they said it's the devil's highway. And people were saying there's more accidents on that road than any other road in the US. Just not true. But
Or it may have been because of people's sort of mad preconception about it. I don't know how that would... Feels unlikely.
I mean, it seems really unlikely. I mean, basically people are idiots.
Then you'd be surprised that people are dying more, on the 4th in East Asia, aren't you?
Yeah, I suppose.
But they are.
Yeah.
Marginally. If we go back to demonomania, so the irrational fear of being possessed by devils, that obviously doesn't exist now because fundamentally people don't really believe in possession by evil spirit. I mean, some people probably do, but generally speaking,
a pretty small
that number. It's a small number of people still believe that. And what you have is a kind of move to understand those conditions as being psychological rather than in some way weirdly sort of metaphysical.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it just, you know, it's just a move from a certain way of thinking about the universe and our place in it, involving God and demons and that kind of stuff, towards a more secular society. So it's sort of, the stuff is probably quite similar, but the explanation and the way we think about it is different.
So it shifted towards like Freud and psychiatry.
Exactly.
Has it shifted even further towards like neuroscience and being able to?
Stuff? So people have tried to look and see what is happening in the brain during, you know, sort of phobias or manic episodes. And as you'd expect, you've got a bit of fight or flight. The amygdala firing. If you're scared of being attacked, or you think you're in a fearful situation because you're presented with the object that you're phobic of. And then you have a bit of, so you can also have a sort of disgust reaction, so slightly different to the fear one. And going back to the animals, sort of being scared of phobic of rats, phobic of slugs, that kind of thing, it's sort of about protecting yourself from infection and disease. But again, that has kind of evolved as people have started to understand how those diseases are actually
transmitted.
Yeah,
so once you know that rats are vectors of disease,
then you
start to maybe sort of fear like any kind of encounter with a rat and find them disgusting.
Yeah.
Like Philippa finds rats disgusting.
Right.
But actually, it's not the rats that are disgusting. It's the human filth and the waste that we leave around.
And the possibility of transmission, which is a reasonable thing to be worried about.
Yeah.
And also, I think that lots of people at school had to read 1984, and the scene with the rats in the in the cage on Winston's face is gruesome.
Yeah.
And you just got, and I have no, fundamentally, I have no idea whether that thing of rats will just bore through whatever's in front of them is true. But when I read that, I believed it. And that does make me feel that's the only route, I think, of me being a bit squeamish about rats.
Yeah.
And purely from one thing.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't fill me with joy, the idea of encountering rats, but I don't find them disgusting.
No, me neither. Me neither. I sort of admire rats, and they're quite sort of resilient and impressive.
All right, so so I'm sort of fine with rats. Philippa finds them disgusting.
Mm.
Other people would obsess over like never wanting anything to do with rats. So what tips you over the edge into a kind of obsession or a phobia?
I think it is just that some people are a bit more prone to it. So genetically. So you might be just a bit more prone to developing obsessive behaviour. It doesn't mean that you will, but if there is a trigger, particularly early in life, then that might just set
it sort of gets wired into you.
Yeah. So it's but it is like, I mean, essentially like everything, it's a combination of genetic and environmental factors.
Yeah.
It feels like we're probably all on a scale. Sliding scale. It's not binary. Like it's not like I am not disgusted by rats. I'm completely disgusted by rats.
Yeah,
it's just that you're just positioned at various points. I think everyone probably is somewhere on those scales. And then if you have really intense, persistent feelings about it, then that might say, yes, you are phobic.
Right.
But you can learn phobias from other people, particularly.
They're very transmissible.
Completely. And that won't be genetic.
You're
not going to inherit a phobia of rats. But if your mum or dad or whatever, or someone you spend a lot of time with when you're young, is phobic of rats and expresses that, you are much more likely to then be phobic of rats.
And the same is true with maths, isn't it? Like when we did our maths episode, if you are phobic of maths, if you have maths anxiety and you try and help your kids with their homework, they become maths anxious, they become maths phobic.
Mm.
And, you know, we've seen it time and again. And So it's weird, like the human brain is so susceptible to influence from those, I guess, close to it, which makes sense because, you know, socially you have to be aware of other cues around you. So I kind of get that it's sort of transmissible. But
I found myself sort of nodding along to some of Rishi Sunak's stuff.
About, I know, isn't that awful?
Attitudes to Maths.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, it doesn't.
I feel like he listened to our podcast, to be honest, and
he must have brought out
all the same arguments.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that whole thing about, oh, you know, we wouldn't, you know, think it was okay for people to say they don't like reading or they can't read.
That's straight from us.
Yeah. I'm ashamed for him, really.
Doesn't really solve the problem that there aren't enough maths teachers.
No. but let's not get onto that now. I want to know, I've seen reports that you can, like, go on these intensive courses and cure your phobias and get over things. I'm pretty sure I've seen footage on TV of people just, like, facing up to their fears.
Yeah,
does that actually work?
Well, I asked Kate.
And there was a woman, for instance, in the late 1950s in London who had a terror of cats. And her husband and children had to scope out any house for cats when they visited friends, for example, and make sure they were out of the way. And the woman's earliest memory of cats was of seeing her father drown some kittens when she was a child. And she'd afterwards been terrified of the family cat, hated, well, fur of all kinds because she associated it with cats. And she underwent an experimental form of exposure therapy in a hospital in London. And she was shown photographs and pictures of cats. Over several weeks, she went to the doctors and they then got her to touch rabbit fur, then cat fur. So she gradually became more, and eventually they placed a kitten on her lap and she just burst into tears of joy and relief because she wasn't, she was no longer scared of it. And she took the kitten home, adopted it as a cat, then got another cat. So this was a happy story. But interestingly, in the course of the treatment, although it wasn't a psychotherapeutic treatment, it was much more practical than that, she talked about her relationship with her father, who had been very controlling of her private life, really. And when she went back to see the doctors after overcoming her phobia, they asked her if she'd had any recurrences of her fear of cats, and she said no, but she did now have dreams of hitting her father over the head with a poker. So it was as if something had been sort of unlocked in her, some acknowledgement of her anger or distress with her father.
Well, I'm no Freud, but she didn't have a fear of cats, did she? She had a fear of her father somehow.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe he looks a bit like a cat. Did he have whiskers? Had a little tail.
He used to drink milk from a saucer.
Had his own special flap that he'd come in crawling through. obviously, people have looked at whether you can cure or treat phobias and manias with, I think, varying amounts of success. And as I said before, like, not that many people come for treatment of them anyway.
Yeah.
Because they...
You just avoid situations.
Yes, the obsessive part, the obsessive compulsive sort of addictive part is a separate thing that we've talked about before. So
yeah.
That's obviously, you know, massively well studied and researched and... You know, people have spent a lot of money trying to develop treatments, but phobias, I think they are trickier. Aversion therapy is one typical method. And I'll just give you an example, because loads of people are scared of spiders, and there's been quite a lot of work with people who have arachnophobia. So there was a guy who was, I think he was in his 40s, and for some reason, he was arachnophobic, and he was going in for an operation to remove his amygdala to try and cure arachnophobia. What was it? He had something else. Whatever. It was epilepsy. It was an epilepsy treatment.
Yeah.
And once it was gone, he was no longer afraid of spiders. So his he was still, and nothing else sort of changed.
Oh, really? Just, so it wasn't that he just lost the capacity for fear?
No, but it was also, it was quite specific. So he had a fear of public speaking, and that remained. But for some reason, the fear of spiders just went quite odd.
Which suggests different, it's primal, doesn't
it? Yeah, it does suggest it's primal. It also suggests that this is not just operating in one place in the brain.
Yeah.
It's not like you've got a sort of just one fear centre or phobia centre, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But so that's quite extreme, clearly. Mm. And also, is it debilitating in any way to be arachnophobic? No.
No.
I think so.
Well, not unless you're in Australia.
Even then.
But then it's common sense, isn't it?
Because yeah, but then you probably want to keep my amygdala because I'm more likely to kill me.
Yeah.
And then, so you can do really brief exposure treatment where you literally are just flashing up images. So you, and so quickly that you're not consciously aware that you're seeing them, and then the rest of the time flashing up pictures of, like, you know, pretty flowers or whatever it is, and just doing that with subjects, that will, it's kind of desensitizing your brain's fear circuitry, and you can do it, and then show that the subjects definitely there is a decrease in their sort of level of arachnophobia. Interestingly, if you do it when you show them the images consciously, so you leave them up for long enough, then A, they hate it during the experiment, and B, it doesn't decrease their
so it has to be quite subliminal.
It has to be subliminal, really, yeah. And then there's another way of approaching it, which is that you get a load of arachnophobes, and then you expose, so like, you know, a version of it, you expose them to a tarantula for a couple of minutes, so they're absolutely shitting themselves, right. And then you immediately give them a beta blocker, and the beta blocker sort of induces a mild amnesia, and it kind of, so it does ooh, something with memory reconsolidation, and that seems to have an effect as well,
yeah,
which is quite interesting. So there's all sorts of ways you can try and go to tackle it, and some of them do seem to work, but fundamentally, in most cases, it's just easier to just avoid the situation that freaks you out, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure people do.
I mean, you sort of work out through your life, don't you, how to avoid these things?
Yeah. So the question is, where do irrational obsessions come from? Still love the idea of mould.
Everything comes from mould, yeah.
But I guess... I don't think anyone really knows. I think a lot of it is cultural.
Yeah.
I think there probably is some evolutionary aspect to it. There's a lot of learned behaviour, so from your parents and others. And then probably from these days, probably from the media.
Yeah,
I guess. Like, I wonder.
Culturally transmitted stuff is really strong, I'm sure.
I'm sure there'd be some really interesting things coming out from the pandemic of what that did to people's kind of phobias and fears.
Yeah.
And that as a kind of collective experience.
Oh, what an interesting question. Yeah.
I don't imagine it's had a positive effect, but it's like.
Yeah. But I mean, so effectively, what you've got is a kind of, you know, some primal stuff from evolutionary.
Yeah, that might be
evolutionary,
useful.
Sort of aversive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's
get away from
sense,
that thing.
Get
it
away
might
from
kill
that
you.
Thing.
Yeah.
And then it gets culturally transmitted.
Yeah.
And because most of us aren't dealing with them, you just pass them on to your kids or whatever, or the people around you.
Mm.
So these things don't go away. They just sort of become pervasive through society in some ways.
Yeah. But also quite illogical and irrational,
yeah.
Because what are you scared of?
Yeah.
Doesn't actually make...
Yeah, I mean, that spider on the bathroom floor is not doing anything to you.
No.
It's going to run away from you if you approach it.
Yeah.
It's not out to get you.
No.
Doesn't seem to help when I say that.
But a clown might be.
Yeah, the clown on the bathroom floor, I mean, that's a whole other thing.
I'll just put him outside. We're going to need quite a big glass, Eva. I did also ask Kate this.
Irrational obsessions, whether manias or phobias, are rooted in our physiology. They trigger processes in our brains that relate to fear and disgust. and they are latent because we need to fear as a species. We would be extinct like the dodo if we didn't, if we weren't scared of threats, of predators, of diseases. And fear, as in the pandemic, it can be deployed to protect us. But the particular extreme and irrational phobias and compulsions that we have as individuals are triggered more by our environments. So those latent anxieties that serve to protect us are distorted, exaggerated, become overwhelming, obsessive because of experiences in our life and things we're taught by the society we live in. So traumatic experiences, frightening imagery, particular beliefs or compulsions in our society, all combine to create a phobia or a mania.
I'm going to make a sort of serious point here, amazingly. I think because phobias are all cultural creations, effectively, and we identify slash invent them, I think they say something quite interesting about what we think about ourselves, because they kind of set out our boundaries in a, like, we've decided, okay, that is an irrational fear. And so I think if you trace the history of them, which actually Kate does a bit in her book, I think it tells you quite a lot about the kind of the mindset, collective mindset of those people.
So does it also tell us that actually we probably don't have enough, we don't have many things to fear in our lives? You know, because I bet, you know, the people who are living in genuinely precarious situations don't have those kinds of fears.
Well, because they wouldn't be irrational, would they? So no one is going to say, well, why are you scared of that saber-toothed tiger? And you go, well, do you remember it ate Johnny? Yeah.
Whereas we, you know, we don't really have that many threats on a day-to-day basis. So maybe the sort of the amygdala is just sort of making shit up to amuse itself.
Also, doesn't it make it a bit more sort of vivid and exciting life that you assign the kind of like mysterious like meaning and force and power to something that doesn't really have anything?
Well, maybe that's just what Freud was kind of getting.
Like everything's a bit sort of dull and grey and monotone, and this makes everything pop.
Yeah.
Because there could be danger over here, or it just sort of makes life a bit more fun.
Yeah. Can I just say also, I've been slightly uncomfortable through the whole of this episode because I keep having mental visions of A, ripping cotton wool apart,
and B,
cutting my own toenails. I know, it's just sort of just been slightly on edge through the whole thing.
If you see toenail clippings, thanks for that. How do you feel about that?
I don't mind seeing toenail. I mean, it's not very nice because somebody's been clipping their toenails.
If I were to pin you down and do your toenails what would I say? Oh, that's a good reaction. What about fingernails?
Fingernails are fine. Nobody cut my fingers when they were cutting my fingernails as a kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, the toe.
Hang on, was he using scissors?
No, it's clippers.
How is he cutting you with clippers? That's careless. That's really careless. Yeah.
That's the least of it, really.
Yeah. We haven't got time to get into that thing.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Kate Summerscale. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london. Or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your yard aren't exactly comfortable, and while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good, while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from sugarcane, they've made the Superlight, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're super natural. Find your perfect pair at allbirds.com today. That's A-L-L-B-I-R-D-S.com.